strolling on the secluded beaches of the outer islands, still hand in hand, naked in the sunlight. Fishing the seething tide race through the main channel at full spring tide, and shouting with excitement as the big golden amberjack came boiling up in the wake, bellies flashing like mirrors, to hit the dancing feather lures and send the pen reels screeching a wild protest and the fiberglass rods nodding and kicking. Out in the humbling silences of the unrestricted ocean, when even the smudge of the islands disappeared beyond the wave crests for minutes at a time, with only the creak and whisper of the rigging, the trembling pregnancy of the mainsail, and the rustle as the twin hulls of the big Hobie Cat knifed the tops off the swells. Strolling the long, curving beaches in the moonlight, searching for the heavenly bodies that so seldom show through the turbid skies of Europe, Orion the Hunter and the Seven Sisters, exclaiming at the stranger constellations of this hemisphere, governed by the great fixed cross in the southern heavens. Each day, beginning and ending in the special wonder and mystery of the circular bed, in loving that welded their bodies and their souls together, each time more securely. Then, on the fourth day, Peter woke to find her gone, and for a moment experienced an appalling sensation of total loss. When she came back to him, he did not recognize her for a breath of time. Then he realized that she had cut away the long dark tresses of her hair, cropped it down short so that it curled close against her skull like the petals of a dark flower. It had the effect of making her seem even taller, her neck like the stem of the flower longer and the curve of the throat accentuated so that it became delicate and swan-like. She saw his expression and explained in a matter-of-fact tone, "I thought some change was necessary if I am to leave under a new identity. It will grow again if you want it that way." She seemed to have changed completely herself, the languid, amorous mood given way to the brisk, business-like efficiency of before. While they ate a last breakfast of sweet yellow papaya and the juice of freshly squeezed limes, she explained her intentions as she went swiftly through the buff envelope that her secretary had silently laid beside her plate. There was a red Israeli diplomatic passport in the envelope. "I will be using the name Ruth Levy," and she picked up the thick booklet of airline tickets, "and I have decided to go back to Jerusalem. I have a house there. It's not in my name, and I do not think anybody else outside of Mossad is aware of it. It will be an ideal base, close to my control at Mossad. I will try to give you what support I can, try to get further information to assist you in the hunt." She passed him a typed sheet of notepaper. "That is a telephone number at Mossad, where you can get a message to me. Use the name Ruth Levy." He memorized the number while she went on talking, and then shredded the sheet of paper. "I have modified the arrangements for my departure," she told him. "We will take the Chris craft across to Bora Bora. It's only 100 miles. I will radio ahead. My friends will meet me off the beach after dark." They crept in through a narrow passage in the coral, with all the lights on the Chris craft doused, Magda's boatman using only what was left of the waning moon and his own intimate knowledge of the islands to take her in. "I wanted Hapiti to see me go ashore alive," she whispered quietly, leaning against Peter's chest to draw comfort from their last minutes together. "I did not exaggerate the danger you might be in if the local people thought what we want Caliph to think." "Hapiti will keep his mouth shut," she assured him, "and will back up your story of a shark attack, unless you order him to tell the truth." "You think of everything." "I've only just found you, monsieur," she chuckled. "I do not want to lose you yet. I have even decided to speak a word to the chief of police on Tahiti when I pass through. He is an old friend. When you get back to Les Neuf Poissons, have my secretary radio Tahiti." She went on quietly, covering every detail of her arrangements, and he could find no omissions. She was interrupted by a soft hail from out of the darkness, and Hapiti throttled the diesels back to idle. They drifted down closer to the loom of the island. A canoe bumped against the side, and Magda turned quickly in his arms, reaching up for his mouth with hers. "Please be careful, Peter," was all that she said. And then she broke away and stepped down into the canoe as Hapiti handed down her single valise. The canoe pushed away immediately and was lost in the dark. There was nothing to wave at, and Peter liked it better that way. But still, he stared back over the stern into the night as the Chris craft groped blindly for the channel again. There was a hollow feeling under his ribs, as though part of himself was missing. He tried to fill it with the memory of Magda that had amused him because it epitomized for him her quick and pragmatic mind. "When the news of your death hits the market, the bottom is going to drop out of Altman's stock." He had realized this halfway through their final discussion that morning. "I hadn't thought of that." He was troubled by the complication. "I had," she smiled serenely. "I estimate it will lose 100 francs a share within the first week after the news breaks." "Doesn't that worry you?" "Not really." She gave that sudden, wicked grin. "I telexed a buying order to Zurich this morning. I expect to show a profit of not less than 100 million francs when the stock bounces back." Again the mischievous flash of green eyes. "I do have to be recompensed for all this inconvenience, n'est-ce pas?" And although he still smiled at the memory, the hollow place remained there inside him. Pierre flew the Tahitian police out to Les Neuf Poissons in the Tri-Islander, and there followed 2 days of questions and statements. Nearly every member of the community wished to make a statement to the police. There had seldom been such entertainment and excitement available on the islands. Nearly all of the statements were glowing eulogies to La Baronne, delivered to the accompaniment of lamentation and weeping. Only Hapiti had first-hand information, and he made the most of this position of importance, embroidering and gilding the tale. He was even able to give a positive identification of the shark as a dead white. The English name startled Peter until he remembered that the movie Jaws was in the island's cassette video library and was undoubtedly the source of the big boatman's inspiration. Hapiti went on to describe its fangs as long and sharp as cane knives and to give a gruesome imitation of the sound they made as they closed on La Baronne. Peter would willingly have gagged him to prevent those flights of imagination, which were not supported by Peter's own statement. But the police sergeant was greatly impressed and encouraged Hapiti to further acts of creation with cries of astonishment. On the last evening, there was a funeral feast on the beach for Magda. It was a moving ritual, and Peter found himself curiously affected when the women of the island, swaying and wailing at the water's edge, cast wreaths of frangipani blooms onto the tide to be carried out beyond the reef. Peter flew back to Tahiti Far with the police the following morning, and they stayed with him, flanking him discreetly on the drive to the headquarters of gendarmerie in the town. However, his interview with the chief of police was brief and courteous. Clearly Magda had been there before him. And if there was no actual exchange of winks and nudges, the commissioner's handshake of farewell was firm and friendly. "Any friend of La Baronne is a friend here." And he used the present tense, then sent Peter back to the airport in an official car. The UTA flight landed in California through that sulphurous, eye-stinging layer of yellow air trapped between sea and mountains. Peter did not leave the airport, but after he had shaved and changed his shirt in the men's room, he found a copy of the Wall Street Journal in the first-class Pan Am Clipper lounge. It was dated the previous day, and the report of Magda Altman's death was on page 3. It was a full column, and Peter was surprised by the depth of the Altman Industries' involvement in the American financial scene. The complex of holdings was listed, followed by a resume of Baron Aaron Altman's career and that of his widow. The cause of death, as given by the Tahitian police, was shark attack while scuba diving in the company of a friend, General Peter Stride. Peter was grimly satisfied that his name was mentioned. Caliph would read it wherever he was, and draw the appropriate conclusion. Peter could expect something to happen now. He was not quite sure what, but he knew that he was being drawn closer to the centre like a fragment of iron to the magnet. He managed to sleep for an hour in one of the big armchairs before the hostess roused him for the Pan Am polar flight to London's Heathrow. He called Pat Stride, his sister-in-law from Heathrow Airport. She was unaffectedly delighted to hear his voice. "Stephen is in Spain, but I'm expecting him home tomorrow before lunch. That is, if his meetings go the way he wants them. They want to build a 36-hole golf course at San Esteban." Stephen's companies owned a complex of tourist hotels on the Spanish coast, and Stephen had to go through the motions with the Spanish authorities. "But why don't you come down to Abbot's Yew tonight? Alex and Priscilla are here, and there'll be an amusing house party for the weekend." He could hear the sudden calculating tone in Pat's voice as she began instinctively to run through the shortlist of potential mates for Peter. After he had accepted and hung up, he dialed the Cambridge number and was relieved that Cynthia's husband, George Barrow, answered. "Give me a Bolshevik intellectual over a neurotic ex-wife any day," he thought, as he greeted Melissa Jane's stepfather warmly. Cynthia was at a meeting of the Faculty Wives Association, and Melissa Jane was auditioning for a part in a production of Gilbert and Sullivan by the local drama society. "How is she?" Peter wanted to know. "I think she's well over it now, Peter. The hand is completely healed. She seems to have settled down." They spoke for a few minutes more, then ran out of conversation. The two women were all they had in common. "Give Melissa Jane my very best love," Peter told him, and picked up a copy of the Financial Times from a newsstand on his way to the Avis desk. He hired a compact, and while waiting for it to be delivered, he searched swiftly through the newspaper for mention of Magda Altman. It was on an inside page, clearly a follow-up article to a previous report of her death. There had been a severe reaction on the London and European stock exchanges. The 100-franc drop in Altman stock that Magda had anticipated had already been exceeded on the Bourse, and again there was a brief mention of his own name in a repetition of the circumstances of her death. He was satisfied with the publicity and with Magda's judgment in buying back her own stock. Indeed, it all seemed to be going a little too smoothly. He became aware of the fateful prickle of apprehension down his spine, his own personal barometer of impending danger. As always, Abbot's Yew was like coming home, and Pat met him on the gravel of the front drive, kissed him with sisterly affection, and linked her arm through his to lead him into the gracious old house. "Stephen will be delighted," she promised him. "I expect he will telephone this evening. He always does when he's away." There was a buff cable envelope propped on the bedside table of the guest room, overlooking the stables that was always reserved for Peter. The message originated at Ben-Gurion Airport, Tel Aviv, and was a single word, the code he had arranged with Magda to let him know that she had arrived safely and without complication. The message gave him a sharp pang of wanting, and he lay in a deep hot bath and thought about her, remembering small details of conversation and shared experience that suddenly were of inflated value. While he toweled himself, he regarded his image in the steamed mirror with a critical eye. He was lean and hard and burned dark as a desert Arab by the Pacific sun. He watched the play of muscle under the tanned skin as he moved, and he knew that he was as fit and as mentally prepared for action as he had ever been, glad that Magda was safely beyond the reach of Caliph's talons, so that he could concentrate all his energies on what his instincts told him must be the final stage of the hunt. He went through to his bedroom with the towel around his waist and stretched out on the bed to wait for the cocktail hour in Pat Stride's rigidly run household. He wondered what made him so certain that this was the lead which would carry him to Caliph. It seemed so slim a chance, and yet the certainty was like a steel thread, and the steel was in his heart. That made him pause. Once again he went carefully over the changes which had taken place within him since his first exposure to Caliph's malignant influence. The fatal miasma of corruption that seemed to spread around Caliph like the poisonous mists from some evil swamp seemed to have engulfed Peter entirely. He thought again of his execution of the blonde girl at Johannesburg, what seemed like 1,000 years before, but with mild surprise realized was months, not years ago. He thought of how he had been prepared to kill both Kingston Parker and Magda Altman, and realized that contact with violence was brutalizing, capable of eroding the principles and convictions which he had believed inviolate after almost 40 years of having lived with them. If this was so, then after Caliph, if he succeeded in destroying him, what was there after Caliph? Would he ever be the same man again? Had he advanced too far beyond the frontiers of social behaviour and conscience? Would he ever go back? He wondered. Then he thought about Magda Altman and realized she was his hope for the future. After Caliph, there would be Magda. These doubts were weakening, he told himself. There must be no distractions now, for once again he was in the arena with the adversary. No distraction, no doubts. Only total concentration on the conflict ahead. He stood up from the bed and began to dress.